Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Fuel your day with Green Fern's new high protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. Thank you as always to Jenny Green. It is Wednesday, the 22nd of September, and this is Game On. Coming up today, we'll be looking back on that much needed win for Vera Powell and the girls in green in Talla last night.
The two Quinns in there. Nifahi makes a move. Goal! Louise Quinn. Fabulous goal. Ireland lead 3-2 against the Australians, and Louise Quinn scores her 12th goal for her country, her 87th cap tonight. That's a peach of a goal.
It was indeed. We're also going to have the latest on the boys in green who saw Carabao Cup action last night. Cuivin Kelleher, very impressive again. We'll chat about him and the rest of the Irish involved in golf. We'll be live to Whistling Straits, where Greg Allen has been catching up with the very strong Irish contingent at the middle of this year's Ryder Cup.
We all watched the Solheim Cup and, you know, we all learned from that. There's no doubt that we want the atmosphere. You know, if you went to every one of my players and said, would you rather play with no fans or 40,000 US fans? And they go, well, let's have the 40,000 fans.
They would indeed. Is there a very strong case to be made that Padraig Harrington is Ireland's most popular sports person? You never hear anyone say anything bad about Padraig Harrington. Or maybe I'm wrong. We will hear from him later. We'll also be going to be live to Kerry to get the very latest on some big names in the mix to manage the kingdom next season.
Game on 2FM.
So if you want to text us about that or anything else that's on your mind, of a sporting nature preferably, you can text us. Our number is 51552. You can tweet us as well, at GameOn. 2FM will get us there. If you've got thoughts, if there's someone who's more popular than Padraig Harrington, I'm happily debated with you between now and 7 o'clock. So all of that to come. Plenty to get stuck into on the programme. One or two headlines of note. UEFA, as one would have expected, have reiterated their concerns around FIFA's plans for a biennial Soccer World Cup. We'll chat about that later on in the programme. Ronald Koeman, a bizarre press conference in Barcelona today, faced the press but refused to take any questions, read a pre-prepared statement about the situation the club finds itself in, and then walked back out the door. So an awful lot of that going on in sport of late. I won't answer the questions. I'll just tell you what I want to tell you, and then we'll leave it at that. And before we go to Kerry, congratulations to Joseph O'Brien, Assemble, winning the Kerry National in Listowel today under Shane Fitzgerald. Assemble winning by 2¾ lengths from the Willie Mullins train pair, Brahma Bull in second and Animix in third. The winner there returned at a price of 9-1. So congratulations, Aidan. We are going to begin, or to Joseph, I should say, we are going to begin with news from Kerry this evening, and so much focus on the managerial merry-go-round that many people expect will take place over the course of the closed season. We've had an awful lot of it in hurling. We are about to have it, one would think, in football. And if it's true, and we've no reason to doubt it, speculation growing that a very, very star-studded Kerry team could be put in place to lead the kingdom for the league and the championship next year. Delighted to say Timmy Moynihan, who's the commentator with Radio Kerry, is with us. Timmy, how are you?
Good, Damien. Good.
It's good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us. Give us a sense of the speculation on the ground. I was saying to people here in the office earlier that if we were to do kind of a Mount Rushmore of Kerry's key figures over the last maybe 10, 15, 20 years, it feels like a couple of very strong contenders are now being put in place to not only take their place on a Kerry Mount Rushmore, but to drive the kingdom forward next year. Give us details of what's been reported with regard to who could be in line to take over potentially.
Yeah, I suppose since we lost to Tyrone, Damien, you know, the question was, will there be change or could there be change? So on that particular evening, I suppose the managerial post and management team posts became vacant in Kerry. So again, would Peter King go, or would he want it? I suppose he would look for an extra year because of the year we had and the pandemic and what have you. But then, I suppose the county board, I'm sure they had their own meeting, and with that, we were hearing different names thrown into the pot each day of the week. And I suppose the way things happened with Jack O'Connor leaving Kildare, you had him, of course, coming into the mix, and he's a proven winner in the past. Then the likes of Seamus Moynihan was mixed into the mix as manager, maybe, but a lot of people were saying he wouldn't have the experience. And I suppose it all transpired with a number of names coming to the fore. That today we saw a tweet, it was actually by our own colleague here in Radio Kerry, Gerry O'Sullivan, where I suppose there, through the grapevine, it's coming that, that Stephen Stack may be a manager of Kerry. Of course, Stephen will be back. He won his first All-Ireland back in 97, and or one of his All-Irelands in 97, and with a coaching team of Mickey Ned, of course, a past All-Ireland winner and manager, of course, of Kerry. And of course, one of the greats of Kerry football, Seamus Moynihan, was into that management team as well. And bringing back Donnie Buckley for a third time as well, and Dara Kaneda. So I suppose, Damien, when you look at that, it's exciting to see the names. And, you know, the one thing, Damien, in Kerry, and you know, somebody would say, look, oh, if Peter Keane leaves, that was the general consensus, who's going to take it? But when you go back, and you just mentioned there in your intro, that there's star-studded performers. There's a lot of All-Ireland medals here in Kerry from the noughties, you know, and they're getting their bit of experience at club and with divisional sides and with the odd county as well. So there's definitely, I suppose, a time for freshness or a need for freshness in Kerry and management. And we're saying with all the All-Ireland medals we have, is there guys from that particular year, the noughties, that could come and do something for Kerry? And suddenly we've come up with this mix today, and I think Joe Connor and other former great Aidan O'Mahony is mentioned on the strength and conditioning side. So sometimes you look at all the names and say, is it overloaded? And maybe it's not, when you'll see everyone, I suppose, that those names will bring something to the table. And maybe that's something probably is hindering or went against Peter as well. Everybody was asking what is his selection or his management team, what are they bringing to the table? Because we heard, I think it made the headlines last year, was Maurice Fitzgerald is going to have a lot more input. But Maurice Fitzgerald was there with 2/3 years. Mm. So suddenly there's going to be a structure in place, and everyone needs to bring something to the table and probably challenge the manager as well.
Yeah, because so the reports certainly are that Dara Kaneda would look after the forwards, Seamus Moynihan the backs, Joe O'Connor, who's done phenomenal work with Limerick in recent years, and Aidan O'Mahony, who is very highly regarded in the locality for strength and conditioning, would look after that side of things. Donnie Buckley to coach the team, Mickey Ned O'Sullivan effectively as the sounding block, and Stephen Stack as the man at the top of the tree. Like, one would think that if that ticket is put together and is accurate, and we've no reason to doubt that it is, it's going to be very, very hard for anyone to beat that in terms of attractiveness. One looking from the outside in, certainly would appear to be the case.
Yeah, and I actually empathise with Peter Keane at the moment, because it's like the waiting game, because he was the guy in position. But I suppose for Peter to survive as well, he'd probably have to freshen up. The onus will be him to freshen up things. So we're hearing nothing from that side of the camp, where if Peter was to come, what would he change or what would he bring to the table again? So that's why it's bonus territory, Damien, for these guys, that everyone is identified. And with that tweet, I suppose, as well, that they're saying every guy is identified, he has a position. And I have spoken on different sports shows, or when I was doing presenting Terrace talking that over the years, and I had Mickey Ned on a few occasions, and Mickey Ned said, and I thought that's what a management team is today, Damien, that a manager must manage his management team to manage the players. And that's what it is. You know, in years gone by, you'd have a manager in Kerry, and then he'd have selectors spread right around the county geographically to give everyone a chance. But now you have to be, in other words, a professional coming to the table. What are you bringing to this? So basically, as you identify there, Seamus, probably one of the best backs, defenders of all time, to play with Kerry. You know, he'd take care of the backs, and as you said, Donnie Buckley for his coach, and in general he'd be the head coach, and Dara Kinnead in the forward. So suddenly you're identifying, and if you did a good presentation with that for the county board and did a good interview, it'd definitely be putting you in the shake-up. So it's very interesting this came to the fore this afternoon.
But when we look at the Roll of Honour, and Kerry out on top as the most decorated football county in the history of the sport, and we look at the noughties, you know, 2000, 2004, 2006, 2007, 2009, like this, you know, constant run of All-Irelands, then the barren years to 2014. Is Peter Keane, in a way, the victim of unrealistic expectation? Because it's not as if, you know, he has failed to bring an All-Ireland back because other managers in the preceding years have failed to bring an All-Ireland back? Or is that a fair observation?
Yeah, I think it's very fair because, you know, I suppose what you're talking about, Pete, he got the position in a sense because of what he returned or delivered at minor level. But I think, and sometimes you'd be torturing the county for saying this, but we had exceptional minors in every one of those minor teams. And suddenly it might cover over a few cracks. Like when you have the likes of David Clifford kicking 4-6 in an All-Ireland final, we saw what Shawnee Shea did and Mac O'Connor, who's gone playing Australian rules, that these were exceptional players and they could win games, if you pardon the pun, on their own. So suddenly, coming off that, then we expected a lot of minors to feed through. And to be very fair to Peter, it was a transitional period and he brought through a number of minors onto that team. And, do you know, I suppose this year, of all years, there was a huge expectation that we said physically the strength and conditioning side would carry us over the line because that was what we were lacking. We were saying we have plenty of football. But there's another side of it down in Kerry. Sometimes we kind of live off our own hype. You know, we build ourselves up so much and we've no divine right anymore. And it's just proven, like, there is a famine, Damien, in Kerry at the minute, because if you think it's the last 10 or 11 times we've gone to Croke Park, we've only had one win in championship. Now that is a desperate return. And you know, if there's a transitional period with players, trying to bring players through, that's what Peter Keane was trying to do. And, you know, the unlucky thing about management, you could work so hard for your 2 or 3 years and suddenly a new crop comes into the management team and they could deliver in All-Ireland and suddenly they're the heroes. And in Kerry, it's very difficult. If you fail over a term, be it 2 or 3 years to deliver, you'll find it very hard to break into the Kerry mix again. And that's why they were saying about the likes of the Jack O'Connors coming back in. Jack has brought All-Ireland to Kerry. And suddenly he was in the mix. But today, when you look at that management team, you're saying, as you said earlier, that it's very hard to argue with. And I take it, even calling those names off this evening, it'll be very difficult for the rest to compete with what they have. And knowing Donny Buckley, and I'm sure he had a huge input in this, the presentation as well, that nothing will be left to doubt. They'll be serious. And they have to do a presentation nowadays. They'll have to... You see, the big thing with Kerry football, Damien, at the moment, that a structure now has to be put, they can get it wrong, because that's what happened, Peter Keane. Suddenly there was nobody to take over, even from his management team. Now we'll have to have succession in place. In other words, there'll be somebody from the, if that is the management team, in 2 or 3 years, if Stephen Stack steps down, somebody to take his place. Yeah. And because I heard Jack, I think a mention of Jack's team, then he had the likes of Declan O'Sullivan in. Now I'd find it very hard for Declan O'Sullivan to see him in with Jack, because he's only had 1 year at the under-20s and not very successful. And a lot of people in Kerry would question that, Declan going in with Jack and leaving the under-20s. So these guys have maturity, may not have the management experience of other guys on their parallels around the country. But I think Tyrone has proven one thing this year, that what they did with joint management, what they can do. And part of this as well, Damon, is about bringing the passion back in. It's kind of lacking. We need the passion and we need the X factor back in Kerry, and that's the attributes of all these guys involved in this management team.
Just, and the other issue as well is the inclusion of Donny Buckley, and you know, we're in a week where the Mayo County Board have drawn attention to harsh criticism and unnecessary focus, and the GAA president has reiterated his views on that. But you know, the inclusion of Donny Buckley will bring extra focus on the management of Peter Keane, because he obviously absented himself from the management team last year, and here he is 12 months on, obviously willing to come on board if we believe these reports. So that is going to change the optics through which Peter Keane's time in charge will either fairly or unfairly be analysed.
Yeah, correct. And I suppose when you analyse, I think it's not the Tyrone game at all that went against. No, when you lose, it is. But I think a lot has gone back to what happened in Cork, losing to Cork the previous year. That really hurt Kerry people, because we were going up, we were playing a Division 3 team, we went defensive, and you could say we were hoodwinked in the end by that goal. And it's in All-Ireland, we could have got run very close, and suddenly there was only one way to correct it, is to go off and win the All-Ireland this year. But you mentioned Donny, but there's going to be pressure, the unfortunate thing, Damien, as well, that there's going to be pressure on this management team to deliver as well. So, you know, we've had defensive frailties over the last number of seasons, was a big question. But there'd be pressure on the likes of Donny Buckley coming in as, man, now we have these guys together, we have the dream team, we're suddenly saying we have the players, They're well conditioned. They're at, you know, guys hitting 24, 25 years of age that have won minor All-Ireland medals with Kerry. Now they are men. So there's actually pressure the minute you take over the Kerry mantle to deliver. But it's just, sport, as you know, Damien, can be as cruel as it can be kind. And that's, you know, maybe Peter another year, maybe he could deliver. Yeah. But suddenly, are the Kerry supporters, stroke the Kerry County Board, are they going to give Peter that chance? And but suddenly, I think this has captured the imagination of a lot of people today, these names being put together. I think a lot of thought has been put into this management team that we're talking about this evening, and it'll be very interesting over the next couple of days.
Just to finish, I wonder in time, will history look at Peter Keane and say he was the right man, perhaps at the wrong time, or, you know, something like that. But he is the manager of all the managers in the inter-county game who keep reporters like us on our toes, because he's a nightmare to interview because he never gives anything away. I asked him the inevitable question after the Tyrone game as to whether or not he still had the hunger to push on for a renewed term. And maybe the elephant in the room in all of this is we don't know definitively if it is something that he actually wants to be involved in, or do we?
Yeah, and even, I suppose, the access to any of these guys, we don't have it at the minute. But the only thing I would say, and I've been in a lot of pressers or press conferences with Peter, it can be very difficult. You know, there's only so far you can do the Eric Kerry thing. You know, and Peter has this, mechanism that he can end up asking you the questions during a press conference. So sometimes when it goes against you, the press will come out and they will question things then. So that's another part of it. And that's actually, it's huge. We know the coaching capabilities here in Kerry. We know every guy from, I suppose, the age of 6 years of age, Damien. If he's a footballer, he can kick with the left and the right. We are good footballers down here. And we need something else. But the big thing over the, and this management team will have to, I suppose, address this as well, that to be able to deal with the media nowadays, and that it's actually huge. People mightn't think, because, you know, you have to go out there, you mightn't say much, but you have to deliver it in a professional way. So all this sort of thing, you need ticking of the boxes. Some managers don't speak to media, they let their assistant coach or assistant manager do it. So there's so many, it's gone so professional, Damien, it's absolutely frightening. But the same thing, I suppose, what we're saying, and to cover it in an overall, like a helicopter look, Damien, is that Kerry is a very proud county, and we feel that, nothing to do with Peter Keane or Eamon Fitzmaurice before him, but we seem to have lost our way. The things that we did well are gone from that, that Kerry ingredient is missing. Okay. And I can see, looking at this management team that we're talking about, we don't know if it's going to be the management team as of yet, but what they'll bring back, Stephen Stack will go through a wall for you as a player. I've seen him at club level here in Kerry as a manager, and the guy, he's nearly kicking every ball with players inside those white lines. So that passion and that little X factor that's needed to match the Tyrones of this world, I think maybe this management team can deliver that,
okay.
You know?
Timmy, we'll wait and see, and crucially, we'll wait and see if Peter Keane is keen or willing to put his name forward again. Timmy, good to talk to you. Thanks so much for your insight. That's Timmy Moynihan there from Radio Kerry on that story emanating from the Kingdom over the course of the afternoon. We're going to reflect on events at Talla Stadium after the break. Stay with us.
Green Farm. Get back on track after summer with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on. Football.
And you're welcome back to the programme. We are going to reflect on events at Talla Stadium yesterday evening. The Republic of Ireland beating Australia by 3-2 in an international friendly, a crucial game in the run-up to what is going to be a hectic period of World Cup qualifiers starting at home to Sweden next month. Emma Duffy from the42.ie is with us. Emma, how are you?
I'm good, Damien. Thanks a million. How are you?
Not a bother. It's good to talk to you. I was stuck in the office last night, so I was watching the game on the television, and I was watching the scenes of the players who consistently spend so much time with the fans after the matches, as is their desire. And I was wondering, was the primary emotion last night maybe more one of joy to get the win or relief to finally get rid of the focus of the 7 consecutive defeats that led into the game?
Yeah, that's the big thing, Damien. I think from the outside looking in, it was probably more so relief. But for the players, there wasn't really that sense. It was more just, you know, joy to get the win, joy to get it in front of the fans, and just a massive boost going into the next campaign, obviously. Like, Australia are a massive nation. Like, we can't forget that. just how good the Matildas are. And Ireland played really, really well last night. It was really encouraging, loads of positives, and just a massive win at the end of the day and a huge performance. And I suppose, obviously, the big talking point is the seven-game losing streak coming to an end. And it just really was a definite shot in the arm and a confidence boost, as I say. And, you know, to score three goals as well, that was huge. In the seven-game loss, in the seven-game run of losses, they had only scored three goals in total. So to score three in 90 minutes, that was amazing. Mm. So really positive times, and as you say, brilliant scenes at the end there as well with the fans.
Yeah, and you know, just to put it in context for people perhaps who haven't tuned into it as much, Australia 11th in the world, Ireland I think down around 33rd in the world, mm-hmm. Australia finished 4th in the Olympics, and you know, even to read the body language and to listen to their coach Tony Gustafsson after the game last night, that this wasn't a let's come to Dublin on a jolly and try a few things out, that they were disgusted not to walk away from Tala last night with more than a defeat.
Yeah, absolutely. And their coach said that, you know, Ireland looked like they wanted it more. And I think that was kind of the case from the outside looking in. Like, Australia were coming in, I suppose they were going to try a few new things as well. They were down a few players, obviously, after a hectic Olympic campaign. But they were coming to Dublin to win. Sam Kerr, their superstar. Everyone who watches a bit of women's football here and there knows who Sam Kerr is. Global superstar, tearing it up with Chelsea in the Women's Super League. She was making her 100th. Cap for Australia last night, so it was obviously a big occasion, a massive celebration, and I think the feeling from Australia at the end of it was they let her down, and you know, Sam Kerr looked frustrated through the game. Louise Quinn, I thought, was absolutely outstanding at the back. Savannah McCarthy too as well. They all did a job in just shutting her out and shutting Australia out in general, and then obviously to get the goals at the other end, just really positive stuff.
And in a way, and you know, if we talk about parity of esteem between the men's game and the women's game, we have to have parity of scrutiny on the two. And like, Stephen Kenny is under so much pressure that there was pressure on Vera Pauw. And you know, I think that the Tyler Toland situation, which we've talked about endlessly on the programme, maybe changed the context within which people were looking at Vera and then the run of results. But in a way, if they can carry last night's form into the qualifiers, it does justify all that we have heard about in terms of playing higher ranked nations in order to increase the standard within the squad and a knowledge of what's required in order to beat the teams considered better than us and hopefully make history and qualify for a tournament.
Absolutely, you're spot on there, because that is the end goal at the end of the day. And I suppose Vera was very strong in her post-match comments that she knows they're on the right track. This is the path they want to be on, and everything seems to be going to plan from their point of view. You know, there were a lot of questions, I suppose, when Australia were chosen as a team to play the final friendly and the final run out before World Cup qualifiers. But, you know, last night they proved that it did work, and that's the thing now. Obviously, it was a big win, a fantastic result, but it's about what happens now going forward. Obviously, going into the business end of things next month, that's when it matters, because last night's 3-2 win over Australia would mean absolutely nothing in a few weeks' time if we don't get results against Finland and perhaps steal something from Sweden as well. Mm.
And, you know, again, it's important to have the you know, it's important to contextualise. We go into this, we were in the third pot of seeds for qualification, so we're going to have to exceed our ranking and our seeding if we're to qualify for the World Cup. But it now starts, and again, you can look at this two ways. It's a ridiculously compact run of games of real magnitude coming up in the coming weeks. Or you can say last night, hopefully, if they can drive it on against Sweden, is the start of momentum that we hope will carry them through to get a good early footing in this group.
Absolutely, and that's the thing, Damien. Momentum is massive in sport, and you know, we've seen it with so many teams. If you get a win or two under your belt, you never know what can happen from there. And obviously, looking at the last campaign, the Euro 2022 campaign, was really, really disappointing, especially the nature it came to an end. Obviously, the two big Germany games at the end, you know, Ireland had probably kind of put their hands up and they wanted to have the job done before that. And the big crunch match against Ukraine ended in a 1-0 away defeat. And, you know, then for Ukraine to go through the playoffs as the second place team in the group and then to be knocked out actually by Northern Ireland, I think that was just a massive disappointment for the Republic in particular, because you look at the pool of players here and just all the different resources and stuff like that, it's massive compared to the North. So that probably did hammer home just how devastating of a defeat that Ukraine one was and how it was a missed opportunity. But look, obviously a new chapter now, and a similar kind of, I suppose, route has to be taken. They're definitely going to target that second spot and hopefully get through the playoffs. But it is a big ask. Sweden are a massive second seed. And it's not going to be any type of walk in the park at all, as we know.
Yeah, but again, you know, we look at the increase in focus and quality in the Women's National League over maybe the last two or three seasons in particular. We look at the level that, you know, you look down through the squad list now for the Republic of Ireland squad, and there's players at established clubs in England, the contingent that are at North Carolina, Courage and Florida State. You know, that the depth of talent is probably greater than it has ever been.
Exactly.
And the depth... So not only is the depth of talent greater than it's ever been, but the level that most of them are competing at is greater than the teams that went before them. So there is great reason for optimism, but there needs to be a sense of realism as well, that it is, we're going to have to return to the giant killing days.
Yeah, I think so. As you say, obviously the players, most of them are full-time footballers at this stage. You know, they play football for a living, it's their job. So there's probably no reason why we shouldn't be punching above our weight and doing better than we are at the minute. Obviously, a massive opportunity to do that now over the next few weeks and months. Well, look, it's a massive challenge ahead. I suppose last night's result was definitely probably a monkey off the back. And then obviously after recent positive developments off the pitch with equal pay and the Sky deal and all these fantastic things happening in women's football, it was time to really deliver on the pitch, and they did that. But as we say, it will likely count for nothing unless they deliver when it really, really matters in a couple of weeks' time.
I think people that were there last night in time might say they saw Mary Fowler in the flesh, because she's clearly a player that's going to really make a massive impact on the international stage if she's not done already. The image of the night is arguably her meeting her grandfather from Ballymun after the game. But from an Irish context, Lucy Quinn, I think half of Sligo was watching the game last night after she made her debut. And like, phenomenal commitment to wait 5 years and pursue your passport for 5 years to try and qualify to play for the Republic of Ireland. But in footballing terms, a real find and a real addition, it would seem, to the squad as well.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose I was really impressed with her start. I've obviously seen a little bit of her in the Women's Super League with Birmingham over the last 2 weeks and in previous seasons too. But I think she started really, really well. You know, her first few touches were phenomenal. The cross across the box, Amber Barrett, and then obviously winning the free kick and scoring it, albeit it might be chalked down as an own goal at this stage. I think, you know, she really set the tone early on and drove on from there. And I think what I was really impressed with was just probably her intelligence and that football brain. You know, she's been around the block. You can see that even just, you know, letting the ball go by her rather than trying to take that touch and start something else. She just is quite a clever player. And I suppose it's no surprise that Vera catapulted her straight in. And after the match last night, you know, she said that she even saw improvements in Heather Payne from playing alongside Lucy, and that's only 90 minutes gone. So she really hit the ground running, was really impressed. As you say, Mary Fowler, it was probably a little bit of an ironic twist to say then that she scored both of Australia's goals, an absolute superstar, and probably one that got away and one that people will rue, and, you know, were really impressed with seeing her last night. But as you say, the scenes afterwards and those lovely moments with her grandfather, I think that was just fantastic, and it just shows that it's about so much more than football at the end of the day too. Yeah,
that reminder as well, the Irish have got to where dust won't get around the world, so we'll see how it all plays out. Emma, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate your insight. Good to talk to you as always. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Damien.
That's Emma
too,
Duffy from the 42.ie with us there. So that was events last night at Tallaght Stadium, and I think 4,000 fans in attendance. And it is great to see, and being the father of a soccer mad, Bohemians mad 9-year-old, it's great to see that the women's national team is like the hottest ticket in town as well, looking for inspiring the next generation. And likewise, that opportunity to a lot of our young men's footballers over the course of the Carabao Cup. I suppose with the established players, Enda Stephen scoring for Sheffield United last night, Seanie McGuire scoring for Preston. But the star man was Ring Matton Rangers' finest, Keaveen Kelleher, played for Liverpool last night in their win over Norwich. Really impressive throughout. Saved a penalty when Liverpool were 1-0 up towards the tail end of the first half, and clearly impressed his manager, Jurgen Klopp.
A lot of individual positives, I suppose, weren't there, with your front two scoring the three goals, your goalkeeper making that crucial save just before half-time.
Yeah. Cleave is a top goalie, yeah? Top goalie, important for him. That his international coach can see that he's really good.
That's Jurgen Klopp chatting to Sky against the backdrop of somebody clearing the empties from the bar in the background quite clearly. We're going to chat about this some more with Fergal. Brennan is with us. Fergal, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Yourself?
Not too bad. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us. One of the big questions today from a Liverpool perspective and an Irish perspective is Keaveen Kelleher, how long is he going to sit at Anfield as a number two, or how long are Liverpool going to be able to hold on to a goalkeeper who could obviously make a very, very significant impact at clubs of a very high standard?
I think it's an ultimate trade-off, really, and it's a decision that Klopp and Kelleher are probably going to have to sit down and have a fairly honest and frank conversation in the next 6 to 12 months, because we know that there's been loan offers over the last season, maybe even two seasons, and Klopp, similar to Pep Guardiola with the likes of Phil Foden and one or two other young players from City, has said to him that he thinks the temptation to go out on loan to get more game time is logical, but that he will learn more and develop more playing within Liverpool, learning from Alisson and getting Carabao Cup games, FA Cup games. He's had a couple of Champions League games last season as well. So I think ultimately, if he is happy with the idea that he is learning more and developing more, playing for one of the best teams in the world, than he would necessarily going out, because the likelihood is that he probably initially would have to drop down to the Championship. It is a bit of a trade-off, and I think he's kind of agreed that in his own head, certainly in the short to medium term, that he is learning more and he is improving by playing within Liverpool. And I think, yes, it is frustrating from him not to be playing regularly, and obviously you look at it from an Irish perspective and you want to see him playing regular football, but goalkeepers now can probably afford to be a little bit more patient than they were in the past. He's 22, he turns 23 in a couple of months' time. Realistically, there's every chance that he's got another 15 years ahead of him. I know it's easy to say that from this position, but at the moment, I don't think we're in a position where this is detrimental to Kelleher's development. I actually think he's progressing very, very well. And I think Liverpool and Klopp's idea is that the question might be asked in 18 months or 2 years' time of, can he take over from Alisson? And I think if Kelleher can kind of stay the course for now, Liverpool have got faith in him that he's up to that job. It's just about resisting the temptation of maybe jumping ship and missing out on what would be an enormous step for him in his career and taking over the number one jersey.
Yeah, because I was looking at it, I was trying to do a tally on it earlier, and by my reckoning, last night was his 10th game for the Liverpool first team. Now, I think three of those were Carabao Cup games in his breakthrough season a couple of years back then, obviously deputised for Alisson in the Premier League and the Champions League last year. And I think, they had a game against Aston Villa where they were forced to play a lot of the 23s, which is the only game that you can kind of think back to say, could he have been a little bit wobbly that night? Because everything that has been thrown at him, he has stood up to it. But even the key thing last night was that leadership role, because he was the glue that was holding that Liverpool defence together.
Yeah, and there was an interesting tweet from him this morning congratulating the young lads on getting their debut.
That at 22 years of age.
Yeah, I think that shows where he is within the squad and that little bit more development that he might have over one or two of the players that started last night. And it is a measure of him, and I don't think, as I said before, I don't think it's necessarily detrimental, the position that he's in now, in terms of his development. It's always so keen, get young players out on loan, get them out of experience. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And generally speaking, when it's elite managers, the likes of Guardiola, which we've seen, he's opted to send Gavin Bazunu to Portsmouth on loan. He was at Rochdale last season. It works in some scenarios. And generally, the elite level managers like Guardiola, like Klopp, etc., they do make the right calls when it comes to these situations. I fully believe Jurgen Klopp knows what is best for Kelleher in terms of his development. And as you saw in the clip there, Klopp loves him. And I do fully believe that he will promote Kelleher if he stays, and if there is the potential that maybe Alisson moves on, maybe he kind of loses a little bit of his sharpness. But it's just on Kelleher to stay the course and stay at Liverpool and take that opportunity.
Just staying with Liverpool before we move on to talk about other things, there's obviously so much focus on Fenway and the lack or the perceived lack of spending in the transfer window during the summer. They've obviously shown the strength of the checkbook today with further and quite considerable development of Anfield announced.
So there's going to be a development of the Anfield Road end, which fans will know is the bottom tier is generally full of the away fans, and then the upper tier is home season ticket holders. So it's in and around 7,500 extra seats, probably take it over 61,000 to 62,000, which would make it the third biggest stadium in the Premier League. This has been rattling on for a couple of years. Obviously, there was massive development to the main stand, but where Anfield is situated, there is a big, long list of hoops to jump through in terms of local council, planning commissions, and obviously Stanley Park is at the back of the Anfield Road end. So there's been a lot to get through, and this has been 3-4 years in the making, and they've now kind of got their decision. They've said it's not going to delay games or disrupt games. They intend to do the building work during the season, try and speed it up a little bit during the off-season in 2022, but they plan to go full speed ahead with this and potentially it could be finished and completed within 18 months.
But see, there's a kind of a catch-22 in all of this, and we will have plenty of people listening who frequent that part of Liverpool. And, you know, I remember being over there a couple of years ago and was like mildly horrified at how much the area around the stadium itself had obviously been bought up by the club and was boarded up, and that's now been developed into kind of common areas and walkways around the ground. But I wonder, if you get the diehard Liverpool fans, is there going to be satisfaction that Anfield has been developed, or is it money that they would rather see go into the first team to ensure that they stay competitive for the Premier League year in, year out?
It's a little bit of a balancing act from the club's point of view. You're right in saying, when you look at the area surrounding Liverpool, Anfield Stadium, that the club have come in for a lot of criticism in terms of their investment, in terms of the way that they've maybe gone about these planning proposals and the way that they have looked to expand the ground. But I think from a supporter position, fans will obviously be frustrated. They want to see the best players in the world playing for Liverpool Football Club and the club chasing some of the big targets that potentially they're not in the race for at the moment. But a stadium expansion is an investment. It might not seem like the most glamorous or the most exciting, but it is an investment. And we do see returns from clubs when they do expand their ground, not obviously just bums on seats in terms of tickets, but in terms of where it brings the club in terms of revenue, investment, all these types of things. And no, it's not as exciting as a brand new centre-forward coming into the team, but it's a very steady, very stable investment that, as I say, the club have been working on for 3 or 4 years. This hasn't been decided overnight. This has been in the work for some time.
Two very quick things to throw at you. We'll stay in Liverpool, but we'll go to the far side of Stanley Park. James Rodriguez, his departure confirmed today, and we'll probably go down now in the pantheon of the greatest Everton player nobody ever saw play, because I don't think he ever set foot in a pitch in front of fans.
I'm not 100%. Someone asked me that just before. I think there was maybe one or two games when there was a little break in the lockdowns last season. This is a very strange situation in terms of James Rodriguez. For me personally, I don't think the move ever sat right. Even last season, when there was little bits and pieces where we saw that the incredible talent that he does have, the entire move right from the get-go, from coming from Real Madrid to Everton, it just never really smelt right. And I think Rafa Benitez coming in, he's such a pragmatist. I think he's looked at the situation and gone, yes, you have an enormous amount of talent, but you clearly don't want to play in my system, don't want to do things this way or that way, and I'm just not willing to bend that much for you. I don't think what we get coming in the other direction warrants me bending over backwards and making little changes. He's an incredibly talented player, but I don't think this has ever sat right. The odd little moment here and there, one or two quite impressive goals that he scored, but all in all, it never really fitted, and I think he just kind of slinks off with his tail between his legs.
Yeah, and I think that's a show of support for Benitez from the club's upper echelons as well. The other story of note today, the reintroduction, or certainly a very significant trialling of safe standing within grounds, which it now seems to be an inevitability that the physical landscape of a lot of the Premier League stadiums and Champions League stadiums will change and will revert to what the older listeners amongst us will remember from days gone by.
Yeah, again, this has been something that's been rankling on for some time, for years and years. There's been fan pressure groups pushing for this, whether it be safe standing put into certain areas of the stadium or a complete and utter overhaul of the way stadiums are set up and the way that people watch football matches. It does seem to be gathering speed. The Premier League and the Championship have come on board now to say that they're expressed an interest in piloting various schemes. I do think it's something that we'll see gradually coming in over the next few seasons. But as we saw at the start of the Premier League and on the back of the Hillsborough disaster, these things don't happen overnight. Revamping stadiums completely, almost rebuilding stadiums, takes years. There will be a bit more opposition further down the road, but there finally seems to be a little bit of movement from the Premier League, because they were one of the biggest opponents to this, because they didn't think it necessarily fitted with the type of football model that they've been trying to promote.
Okay, Fergal, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us. Fergal Brennan joining us there. So plenty to reflect upon there. We will wait and see how that plays out in course. We're going to check in at Whistling Straits. The Ryder Cup build-up continues, and we're going to chat to Greg and hear from some of those involved after this.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on. Go.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. We are going to go to Whistling Straits, where Greg Allen is in situ in advance of this year's Ryder Cup. Greg, how are you?
I'm reasonably good, Damien.
Well, that's
good day out there. Could be an Irish summer's day, if you know what I mean. That type of weather.
It's you know, the listeners don't need to know this, but you know the logistics and the physics of the studio I'm in. I came in, it was gloriously sunny. I haven't got a window to look out in the world, but I'm hoping it will be likewise. But there could have been a tornado since I walked in, but, you know, you're probably getting a better day than I. Come here, before we this has been kind of building up nicely. I never feel as European as I do when the Ryder Cup rolls around. I cannot wait for it to get underway on Friday and to enjoy it across the weekend. And there's a kind of a nice sizzle building up between the two teams over the course of the last couple of days.
It's very typical of the Ryder Cup that it's like this. It's actually quite low-key. There hasn't been any sort of big controversial story that has evolved during the week. Often these preview days are fodder for newspapers and websites to prod away at teams in press conferences and try to get somebody to say something they shouldn't say, if you know what I mean. And there's been none of that. I actually think it's just simmering. I don't think it's sizzling. I think it's going to be a very much orientated towards the 3 days of play. We're not going to have a scenario, say, like 2016, which was hugely distracting for Europe when Danny Willett's brother wrote an article in the magazine which created a huge degree of angst among the American crowd and really fueled their, I suppose, almost animosity towards Europe well before the matches began. There's been nothing like that, and I don't anticipate there will be. Paddy Carrington is just doing an incredible job as a man to go in front of a microphone and calm the waters all around. He is just so totally in control of that side of the operation here that, you know, Steve Stricker may have the best team that's ever been put out in a Ryder Cup in terms of world rankings. But Paddy Carrington is doing a stellar job so far as captain in really promoting the underdog status of Europe and keeping it low-key and, you know, I suppose waiting till Friday.
So we're still in the kind of speculative world of who will be paired with who. And, you know, I know, was it Nick Faldo had his sandwich list sticking out of his back pocket 1 year? Like, we haven't had any real, you know, have we had solid indications of how we're going to see players paired?
Nope. From the European point of view, I think Paddy Carrington is playing, not a game, I think he's playing his cards really quite close to his chest, more so than before. The pairings that have the groupings that have gone out for Europe today, let's just take the top pairing on the course, or the top four ball on the course in practice: Garcia, Hatton, Lowry and Ram. That grouping yesterday had Hatton, Lowry and Ram all together, with the one exception being Fleetwood in instead of Garcia. So you start to think that that might be pointing towards maybe Lowry and Ram being a partnership, and that looks like actually, you know, one that would really, really work. You know, they're two very emotional, heart and sleeve type of people, Shane Lowry and John Ram. So I think perhaps you could say there is something to be read into that. But you know what? Let's hear what Paddy Carrington had to say about how he's been revealing or not revealing his partnerships over the last sort of day and a half. He spoke to me yesterday about exactly that.
I have you guys exactly where I want you. Yeah, look, it's I'm not a big fan of players, you know, playing with the same guys over and over. I'm a big fan of the team, and I like each player to have an experience of playing with the other players during the week. But, you know, nothing there. I'm certainly not setting out anything in stone in practice rounds. And at some stage, obviously, partners are going to have to play together, but I'm not a big fan of over-familiarity either in that sense. So read what you like into it. Because I'm not going to tell you.
You said last week that, you know, players had come up to you saying that they'd like to play with such and such, and obviously you've had to give that consideration. And when you put all of that together and your own thoughts, have you in your mind now your pairings pretty much for the first 2 days even, or even day one?
I have a strong opinion of where we're at with the pairings, and we have a very nice set of pairings, and there wasn't very many people who said no to anybody else. So really, that just, you know, there was one or two that just didn't feel like it might have been the right fit for them. So it wasn't a difficult thing. It would be taken into consideration, but as it turned out, it didn't need to be.
Rory McIlroy in his press conference spoke about being inspired by the Solheim Cup performance of Europe, and the fact that the way they, the women of Europe, thwarted the taunting that they got. You're going to get at least as much of that taunting probably, or your players probably will, judging by previous Ryder Cups in American soil. Have you got a plan for that?
Yeah, you know, we all watched the Solheim Cup, and, you know, we all learned from that. There's no doubt that we want the atmosphere. You know, if you went to every one of my players and said, would you rather play with no fans or 40,000 US fans? And they go, well, let's have the 40,000 fans. I think they understand what's ahead of them, and they have to embrace it. There's no choice in that. So, yeah, look, they're well able to deal with it. It's only sticks and stones. Like, it's not like it's anything more than that. So, yeah, the players will be well capable and taking their lead from the Solheim Cup.
And just finally, at the very outset of this process, when you were named Ryder Cup captain, you expressed some sort of apprehension about would you be the right sort of person to put an arm around a shoulder or to do all the things that every captain is supposedly has to be good at. And you can't be good at everything. But do you think you're the right sort of captain for Europe in what is a very difficult circumstance?
I have no apprehensions right now.
You're just looking forward to the week?
I'm absolutely delighted to be here. Just, it's great, it's exciting, it's fun, everything about it. So I'm thrilled that I didn't second guess it.
So that was Paddy Carrington speaking to me, and I have to say, like, exactly as he is portraying it, he is not remotely getting into all of the psychology that can happen over these days before the matches actually begin. He's too many times around the block. He's been multiple time player and vice captain. He's seen other vice captains and captains do, you know, things before the matches begin, which would give you an indication that a certain pairing is going to go out, and then that pairing isn't one that materializes. And there's an awful lot of prediction about who will be playing with whom, and I don't think you can read a huge amount into these predictions. I think this is going to be very, very difficult to work out what's in Paddy Carrington's mind, mainly because that's the kind of complex character he is. I think with regard to the other groupings on the course today, McIlroy and Poulter are practicing together again. That might be one that is going to be possibly a foursomes partnership, but even a four-ball partnership, because it was in four-ball in 2012 in Medina that the McIlroy-Poulter partnership basically turned that match around when they were behind with six holes to play. McIlroy birdied the 13th in Medina and Poulter birdied the last five. So they've got a really good vibe about them. The fact that they've been practicing together for 2 days, that's possibly a pairing that I'd look at. But I wouldn't like to really look at what's going on inside Patrick's head at the moment. But I do think that Lowry and Rahm practicing 2 days in a row might be significant. And Lowry and Fleetwood, who of course played with each other in the final round in Port Rush in the Open in 2019, they practiced together yesterday. They're not practicing together today. That might be one as well. And here's another one I think as well that might well happen, but isn't being flagged. And that's Lowry and McIlroy. They don't need to practice together. They play recreational golf with each other quite frequently in Florida. They live 10 minutes away from each other. What's necessarily going to be benefiting them from practicing together here? I don't think a whole lot, because they know each other's games so well, and they've played golf together in competitive terms back as far as the 2007 European Team Senior Championship, which Ireland won. So that partnership is well established, although they don't necessarily have to play with each other. When you look at the American side of things, Damien, it's different. They're all playing in pods. Yesterday, in this pod system, which was invented by Navy SEALs, it's a militaristic approach. Paul Azinger picked it up in 2008, adapted it for the Ryder Cup team then, and they were very successful in America with the pod system. But yesterday's pods are different to today's pods, slightly different. So even Steve Stricker is moving things around. But if you're looking at a cast iron partnership there, Cantlay and Schauffele, to me, looks like, you know, they're just going to be a certain partnership, possibly play all four of the first matches over the first 2 days. They are two hugely informed players. Cantlay is the FedEx Cup winner. Schauffele is the Olympic champion. And I just think that that is going to be a cast iron partnership for the Americans. But I wouldn't lock in any other partnerships from what I've seen so far and what's gone out in the golf course.
Okay, Greg, before I let you go, and I know we're going to chat more about this in tomorrow, and obviously action will be underway on Friday. Where does this rank for you in terms of the overall pantheon of, you know, it's not a major, but it is remarkably special. Like, this is one of my bucket list events. Does it have that same sense of kind of excitement for you and for everyone else there?
I think what you've just said is more revealing than anything I can say about this. You like watching golf a bit, Damien. It wouldn't be your core sport, but for so many, possibly people for whom golf is not their core sport, the Ryder Cup appeals on a transcendent basis across a huge amount of sports fans' interest, and it's not necessarily a golf fans' event. It is, of course, something which is of huge interest to golf fans, but the Ryder Cup transcends the sport of golf, brings it to a much wider audience, because there's a team element, hand-to-hand combat almost, and it can get very, very feisty, like a football match. I hope I'm not understating your interest in golf by saying that.
No, you're not at all.
But I hope you get the point I'm making, is that it really appeals to a much broader audience than any other golf event, I believe.
Yeah, I'm exposing myself to be a golfing philistine, but anyway.
Well, I remember you doing interviews with the Irish Open in 2008 in a dare manner and doing a very good job. So I'm going to give you lots of plus marks for that.
Yeah, and I never got sent back since. Anyway, Greg, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to chatting to you about it more tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to how it all plays out over the weekend. Stay safe, and we will chat tomorrow, no doubt. Thanks very much. It's Greg Allen joining us there from Whistling Straits. Much more on that to come tomorrow. It's time for us to depart. Tara's on the way. Thanks to Ronan Lawler, was our producer tonight. Laura Lee Davies, our broadcast coordinator. From Damien O'Mara, until we chat tomorrow, good night.
With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.